Hi, Eddie here. Red and I have used Zencastr to record all of our episodes of Punk Rock Elite because it's easy, browser-based, and it gives us separate tracks that are easy for me to edit. It can also be used for 4K video too. Maybe we'll try that one day. It's really easy to use. It can do a lot of the editing for you, clipping out your ums and ahs, and adding an EQ to bring out the best in your voice, all from a single website. If you want to make a podcast but aren't sure how to go about it, then Zencastr provides everything you need to record, edit, and distribute your new show to Spotify, Apple, and a ton of other places that people get their podcasts. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use our code PUNKROCKELITE, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story. Punk Rock Elite, a podcast about NoFX. Surprise, it's us again. Weren't expecting that when you pressed Punk Rock Elite, were you?
No.
Well, that's just what we've got now, isn't it? That's just how we're doing this. Hello, everyone. It's me, Eddie French.
And it's me, Red Redmond.
On Punk Rock Elite, a podcast about NoFX, where we do anything we can to not talk about NoFX.
Especially this week.
Yes, this week. This week we've got an episode of Under the Influence, where we look at a record that NoFX, and by NoFX in this instance we do specifically mean Mike from NoFX, wanked on about ad nauseum about how super influential and important it is, was, and will be to NoFX and the music that they've gone on to make. So that's what we're doing. That's what Under the Influence is, not to be confused with Peer Pressure, where we look at records from NoFX's peers. This year we're focusing mainly on those released in 1994, because they're all 30 years old. But we've got other stuff to do a quick chat on first. So how have you been? What have you been up to?
Not too much. My last night, me and my partner discovered that my rabbits can just escape their house that they sleep in. So we've had to improvise a more secure area for them right now. They're getting very chewy, so you can't just give them free rein all the time. You can if you can keep an eye on them.
Right, but otherwise they'll chew through all of your electrics and... And then they'll
and like
do
books,
that thing.
You know, like I've got some like books that are quite important to me, but they're on like floor level bookshelves and they keep having a chew.
When I was at university, a friend of mine had rats.
Oh no.
Pet rats, not an infestation. I mean, he just kept them in his... We were in halls of residence. He just kept them, and anytime anyone's like... They said, oh, you shouldn't really have, we can't let you have pets. He'd just go, oh, my mum's dead ill and they're hers. And I mean, I'm sure the guy was a psychopath. But with all of the sort of charm and charisma that goes along with that. And they were just like, oh, well, you didn't tell us that, you little angel. Of course you can keep your rats. So, but anytime you borrowed a book off of him, there'd always be like half a page missing because he'd have been reading it. And then he'd have looked over or answered his phone or something, and a rat would have just run off with half a page. So
sure.
I borrowed 48 by James Herbert, and James Herbert has written about rats extensively in his career. And so this sort of weird horror novel where there's like sort of half devoured corpses from various vermin and stuff. And you're like, oh, this book itself has been eaten by rats. This is... this is possibly the author's preferred text. I don't know. It's good. Is there any way of preventing them from doing that, or is it
just
not give them the opportunity?
You can't teach like logic and stuff to rabbits. They just don't care. No. You know, like, you can block things off and hope for the best.
Sure. Fair enough. Well, I've got to point out, this is quite exciting. We've got quite a lot of correspondence.
Oh, great!
From the last couple of episodes. So I'm going to go in order. Daniel Powell of the Across the Stewniverse podcast.
Yep.
Directly inspired by this one, has written so much. I'm going to skip through it because there's a lot here, and that's fine. He's a big Green Day fan, as you can tell.
Sure, of course.
Listen to it whilst walking around Sainsbury's, which is a supermarket for our international listeners. TLDR. Oh, that's good. Really enjoyed this episode. Thank you. Okay, yeah, cheers. Cheers, Daniel. No, there's so much here. This isn't like one of those Offspring fans having a pop at you. Gotta say, Green Day fans, much more polite than Offspring fans.
You know, I would have expected that as well.
Yeah, maybe you're,
you know,
right,
they're good people. They're kind to their mothers, Green Day fans.
Yes, they don't need all of that. I mean, all of the rude words that they put in, like Offspring do, where they encourage everyone to shout.
No effing and jeffing.
None of that. Just proper stuff. Just songs about visiting male prostitutes like they used to sing in old days. Didn't need bad language to do a good song in them days. Things I'm Glad Were Said.
Sure.
One of the best produced albums of the 90s. Rob Cavallo, unheralded fourth member of Green Day. Yeah, mm-hmm. I believe so. Mike Dirnt's bass playing disappearing at some point around Warning. Yeah. He used to play brilliant bass lines, and then he's just happy to be a root note guy.
Yeah.
Fine, whatever you like. This is a songwriter album disguised as a punk album. Yeah.
Yeah, agree with that, absolutely.
Interesting things I thought about when listening. I mentioned Everly Brothers feel. I think that was on the I'm All Busted Up, that one, I forget its name, but that one, it's got sort of harmonies running through it. Billy Joe Armstrong and Norah Jones made an Everly Brothers cover album called Foreverly many moons ago.
No way. That's so funny.
Yes.
How interesting.
Daniel states that he liked it. Many did not, but I just turned 30 when I bought it and was feeling melancholy. If you listen to any of the demos on the 30th anniversary reissue, you'll hear, especially with Basket Case, that Rob Cavallo was a huge part of his success from an arrangement perspective. Basket Case changed almost wholesale from the demo. I did actually listen to that because the lyrics are so different as well. They're like...
That is interesting. I'd love to listen to that.
It's just sort of, I think it's like hand claps and a shaker for the percussion. It's like a four-track demo that he's made himself. It wasn't like a band demo. You mentioned still being able to piss off parents. Reminded me of the story in the song Reject on Nimrod, written in response to a parent who wrote Billy Joe Armstrong a letter condemning Insomniac as filth, saying they'd love listening to Dookie with their 8-year-old in the car, but that the follow-up was the devil's work. Daniel also says Coming Clean is his favourite song. He's even got a tattoo of it. So there you go.
Oh, nice.
So, yes, thank you for that. We did get some very nice responses from all of these things. However, we got many, many more responses from our live episode.
Sure, of course.
Because it was a bit different to what we normally do. People seemed to really, really go for it. You'll remember we mentioned Greg from Unscripted Moments. Greg turned up on our Insta saying, notice how nobody listed any other 21st century excellent songs. Greg put forward the idea that Total Bummer was the only excellent 21st century NoFX song. And the audience scoffed, but as Greg points out, no one suggested any songs that were excellent. We didn't get... To be honest, I think we were going to, but we got sidetracked because it was more of a free-flowing conversation. But, yep, touche. He said, Dinosaurs Will Die is good, but is it excellent? Eh.
I mean, I think 6 Years on Dope is definitely excellent.
Yeah, I'd put that as a suggestion. My three suggestions were Sid and Nancy, 6 years on dope and the Idiots Are Taking Over, just off the top of my head.
Oh, yeah, Idiots Are Taking Over. What? So, like, yeah, is he just writing off all of War on Errorism?
Everything after Valum, and it was War on Errorism.
Franco on American, I don't know.
We could go into a list of it, but I think that's the trick he's trying to draw us into. The RIP radio, or the RIP, I think it's the RIP. The RIP radio says, oh God, flashback to attempting to do no effects drums on the microphone. Yeah, well, it remained in there. It wasn't too much of an issue after all, but that's that's fine. We've got an email here from Ali Bryce.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Lovely to see you at MPF last weekend. I missed the deadline for NoFX hot takes, but I thought I'd share one I've held for a long time that occurred to me in the shower this morning.
Great.
One, whilst I absolutely believe Fat Mike is a huge fan of drugs and takes, or at least used to take, loads of them, I don't believe he is ever as wasted as he says he is when playing live. How can you be that fucked up, then play so tightly?
Yeah, I
would agree. I think some of those songs he's been playing for so long, and for so long just under the influence of a few beers, or maybe more than a few beers on occasion, but you know, there's a bit of muscle memory there. But yes, I agree. I think the peak of his drug taking is probably past, because he used to take it to make playing gigs more interesting. That was the main reason he did it. I think he said that initially he took cocaine so that he could carry on drinking, because it helped reset you a little bit, apparently. He was always a pill guy. He was always like, oh yeah, take a Valium for this, take a sleeping pill for this, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's probably, I mean, I don't know how you feel about that one, Red.
Yeah, no, I would be inclined to agree. I think he is obviously under the influence of certain things, but yeah, I think there's certainly a limit to what you can take on stage and still be able to perform. I think after a couple of beers and maybe even, you know, and a couple of lines of something, you can probably still perform. But I think past that, it's going to really impede your ability to play, particularly at the speed that they do play. And I think you're right in that. I mean, he's definitely not taking anywhere near as many drugs as he used to, if at all, on stage, you know, like four gigs. I mean, like, I'm sure he was drinking at the show that we saw in Leeds last year, but I don't think that...
I mean, he may well have been on a small amount of performance enhancing, because there comes a point where, I mean, apparently I've read this years and years ago, because there were, after at certain points, especially sort of around like when clubbing became a big thing and people were doing like cocaine and ecstasy and like not actually drinking booze, because they were just like, back in those days, one pill would be good enough to last you a whole evening. You'd be like, oh no, this is fine, I'm all right. They did an investigation into what drug driving, because we know what drink driving looks like. You're less likely to respond quickly and all those kind of things. And so they did, and they found that cocaine improved your driving in like the first 10 minutes after taking it, and then after that, no.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But so, you know, if you want to be super safe at driving and you've got less than 10 minutes to go there, then a line off the dashboard, you will be the safest driver on the road.
I'm better at Mario Kart after a couple joints than I am sober.
You're better at most things after a couple of joints than sober, though. that's how you've developed yourself.
Yeah, fair.
Just, I mean, you know, I don't know what I don't know when I've ever seen you not after a couple of joints, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're recording this at 11 in the morning.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know, but it is medicine now. It's officially medicine.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter.
It's officially medicine for you. So I wouldn't tell someone not to take their insulin before recording. So why would I tell you not to, you know, that's stupid. That's stupid and backward and unsupportive, so I wouldn't do it. And number two, Ali says, I think Cameron Webb had a much larger part in the songwriting on First Ditch Efforts than just being a producer. It is a fantastic album. Yes, absolutely agree. Thank you, Ali.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's onto something here.
But to my ears, is so different to the rest of their catalogue that I feel something is going on.
Yeah.
The songwriting takes a massive step up, then falls back down for SA and DA.
Absolutely.
And those albums sound more like NoFX albums than First Ditch Effort does, if we look at their discography as a whole. I like this a lot.
The only thing where I give benefit to, you know, Mike and the boys is where I think the songwriting on First Ditch Effort is exemplary, but I do think there are other albums that match it. And I know, like, I'm a big fan of Coaster, but like the arrangement of the songs on Coaster and their songwriting, like that album could be a lot worse. I don't know. Like, I do think that they've made other albums with a similar quality of songwriting, but I do agree it all feels very suspicious when it's followed by albums nowhere near as good.
I think when you're talking about that era of NoFX, you've got Coaster, you've got First Ditch Effort, but around those, you've got things like Self-Entitled and Single and Double, which to me sort of feel lesser than their average. We need to do that tier ranking show that we talked about. We need to rank the albums in our, or all the releases in our minds. I think we need to do that.
Definitely.
At some point. Let us know if you'd like us to hear us do that. Because I think it would also just be useful to print it out and have it there just so we know how we feel about things.
Yeah.
I actually think on Oxymoronic, my least favorite song on First Ditch Effort, right at the end, on the CD version, right at the end, you hear a conversation between Fat Mike and Cameron Webb.
Yes.
Talking about the lyrics for it and saying, you know, what are you doing? What are you saying? Like most of, or kind of, it's like, it's nothing. And then he changes the thing. He goes, there you go. That's fucking better.
Yeah.
Like, he's giving him quite a hard time about it, but he gets a better lyric out of him just on the spot. Now, it's not that Mike can't write a lyric, because he's written thousands of, you know, of lines of lyrics of varying quality, but everyone has. So
I think that there's just that there is an editing process on their better albums that aren't there on their lesser albums. I think that on their lesser albums, like Single Album and Double Album, I get very much the feeling that Mike wrote a song and then got the members of NoFX to record that song. And I just don't think that he's taking notes or attempting to improve things past a certain point. I think he's like, yeah, that's a song. Let's record that.
It seems to be very insular. It seems to be, it's always been Mike writes stuff. I think he even writes sort of like the horn parts and stuff. He like sort of explains how they should go. I know that for this guitar solo process, Hefe will record several guitar solos, take several passes. Mike will go, I like that first bit from that one and the second bit from that one. And I like the ending where you did that. And then Hefe will put it together and Mike will go, there you go. That's what I wanted it to sound like. You know, the riffs and stuff. I think he writes mainly on guitar and then plays on bass. So he writes sort of the riffs and stuff. We know that from little glimpses here and there of how it works, we know that's how they sort of do stuff. And I think there's even less of that. Apparently with the Single and Double stuff, when he was, because he was living at Six Flogs with Johnny from Old Man Markley and some other people, you know, but he and Johnny were doing a lot of demoing, and they were programming the drums in whatever digital audio workstation that they were using, and then asking Smelly to like do that. can you just do that drum beat? And he's like, not really, no, that's not a natural drum beat. Like, yeah, no, but learn it. So it was less, I think it's been less collaborative and more dictatorial.
Yeah.
Even though it was reasonably dictatorial throughout, it's always kind of been, Mike knows what the song sounds like in his head. He's got that, you know, the auteur Hitchcockian thing. When I see my film, it's the second time I've seen it because I've already seen it once in my head. You know, that kind of thing. So, and I think with it being locked down and sort of he and Johnny presumably getting quite close because they were, you know, living together, working together, that's possibly where this new sort of new normal for them came in. Anyway, but thank you, Ali. That's I think we tend to agree with both of those hot takes, which is great. And we've got Greg from Jersey as well, who's written in to ask. Firstly, says, hope you're both doing well. Thank you, Greg. We hope you're doing well. Any chance in future podcasts you guys are going to discuss 70s punk bands, Ramones, Clash, New York Dolls, etc.? I have written back because Greg's got an amazing way of sending an email just after we finished recording an episode. So it's like receives it and then doesn't get response for well over a week. So I did just write back, but I'll say what I said and we'll see what you feel about this one, Red. But I said not in the immediate future. We've got no immediate plans for 70s stuff. Simply because it doesn't really concern our show.
Sure.
Which is, I know we're called Punk Rock Elite, but we're sort of, I think we're sort of like 90s focused with some 80s coming in as well. And yeah, then, and like 90s onwards. But, you know, we sort of don't really, classic punk, all of those sort of, you know, the Ramones, the Clash, the Sex Pistols, the New York Dolls, those sort of big four that people talk about, they've been covered in such minute detail by so many people. I don't really know what we can bring to the party. Whereas I don't think the stuff we talk about has been spoken about in as much detail. But that's my position on it. Red might have a different one.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I had to double check when Fresh Fruit and Rotten Vegetables came out, because I think that's possibly as early as we would potentially go.
And I think that's an outlier as well, because that's what, 79 or something?
It's 80. So 80, it's, okay. You know, it's not in the 70s. And I think, you know, like potentially, you know, we could cover that. We could cover, you know, Bad Brains. But this is all 80s DC stuff. I see that as being like probably far back we go.
I think we don't really have as close a connection with punk as we do with those subgenres that came out afterwards, such as like hardcore.
Yeah, I'd say
skate punk and stuff. I mean, we talk about punk. I refer to all of it as punk rock because it is.
Yeah,
but that can be misleading because some people hear punk or punk rock and think, "We're too deep up," and I understand why they do. That's not weird to do that, but it's not exactly what we're talking about, I suppose. But that's not to say we never will. It depends how long this bloody thing goes on for, I suppose. You know, we could, might find ourselves running out. And I love the Clash and the Ramones. They're two of my absolute favorites, but I feel less connected to them because, I mean, the Clash were long gone by the time I was born. I mean, the Ramones, I never saw the Ramones, but they, when did they split up, like 97 or something mad? It was like mid-90s anyway. And Greg also has another question, which is, what is your prep work when coming up with the show? I only ask because the discussion you two have is really in depth. I can't imagine you just listened to an album once or twice and then got on the mic.
No, that's exactly 100% what we do.
I mean, I did have to say yes. I'll tell you how I do it, okay, right? If we're doing an album, I'll listen to the album. That's not it. I'll listen to the album, just sort of on its own. The second time I'll listen to it, I will make notes.
Yes.
And then I will listen to it again the morning of the show. We record about 11 a.m. Typically, we record about 11 a.m. on a Thursday morning. So at around 9:30 or 10, I will listen to the album again and read my notes through, maybe add one or two things. But I just sort of want to, because I know we sort of talk about the songs in depth, but I find myself more and more listening to albums as a whole piece, which is how I prefer to listen to them, with sort of the ups and downs, and they all flow into one another. So sometimes we'll go, oh, that song is shit. You go, well, yeah, on its own it sort of is, but as a bridger between these two other songs, it makes total sense. It's sequencing, as we now know the word for that. So that's how I do it. I don't know if Red does more or less than I do.
I aim for exactly what you do, but I rarely make the third the third pass over the album. It depends on the length of the album. So for the episode today, I have only been able to listen to it twice. But
it is a long album.
Yeah, because it's much longer than what we'd usually review on this show anyway. Mm-hmm. I generally try and get three listens, and one of those listens will involve notes.
And we never actually conferred on that. I think we just naturally just went, well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because I mean, obviously for something like Slat Fats, that isn't how I did it, because I didn't need any notes, because I've listened to that album 1,000 times. It's one of my favorites ever, so I sort of know it already. As for the background and stuff, we just use Wikipedia or some memories of stuff that I have from long ago, which has been pointed out as being false in the past. But, you know, if Kerrang in 1997 was wrong, then I don't want to be right. Or if my failing memory of that issue of Kerrang, if you are interested in Kerrang, by the way, Kerrang magazine, Stew Face Down, from the Face Down Club Night and the Black Charade, My Chem tribute band, he bought a buttload of back issues off of eBay, and he reviews them on TikTok. He just goes through issues of Kerrang and showing you what the features were and what reviews albums got and stuff. They're pretty fun. Some of them go up on Insta as well, which is where I see them, because I'm too old and frightened to look at TikTok. Thank you so much for getting in touch, everybody. We love to hear it. Gosh, that was a long intro. Well, it doesn't matter, because we're going now straight into Rock and Roll Nightmare by RKL. Hello, everyone. Eddie here. Red and I hope you're enjoying our show. If you have been and would like to help us make it a little more easily, then you can donate to us at our Ko-fi page, which is ko-fi.com/punkrockelite, or you can look in the show notes for our link tree. If you can't help us financially, we totally understand, but would love it if you spread the word to other people who would like this podcast. We thank you for your continued support. We massively appreciate it. Back to the show.
Tell you what, Hugo, I've only gone and got us a couple of ruddy tabs.
No way.
Yeah, no, seriously, I hear that you, like, trip absolute balls on it. The gardener got me them. It's incredible, yeah.
I'm glad, actually, because I could do with some acid after the night I've had. Oh, I've rocked. I've rolled.
Oh, no.
I had a nightmare.
Oh, dear.
It's a Rock and Roll Nightmare.
Rock and Roll Nightmare by Rich Kids on LSD. All right, then. So, not to be confused, this is the 1987 album. Not to be confused with the 1987 movie Rock and Roll Nightmare, a Canadian direct-to-video horror film starring heavy metal musician John Mikiel Thor.
Oh, of course, John Mikiel Thor.
Yeah. 83 minutes long, budget of $52,000. I mean, I do want to see it. Just look at the cover of it. It looks like one of the hellhounds from Ghostbusters in front of a real homoerotic muscle man with a demi-wave It's metal as fuck. It's
that's quite great. Interesting because isn't Rock and Roll High School both an album and a movie?
Yes, but they are connected because it does have the Ramones in it. The Rock and Roll High School is a better album than a movie. The movie is bad.
Yeah, I've heard the movie's not really watchable.
The Ramones are barely in it. They play the prom at the end or the school dance. They're the band for it. And Dee Dee Ramone had his lines cut because he couldn't say them properly. And the whole thing, all he does is just go, "Hey, pizza." It's really funny. So, Rock and Roll Nightmare, 1987, released on Alchemy Records. It was then re-released in 1993 on Epitaph Records. So, it is about 47 minutes long.
You know, again, I said it before, it's basically jazz, isn't it?
This is not the first time, or this is not the last time I will be bringing up the length of this album, just so everyone knows. So it was Rich Kids on LSD. They were formed 5 years previous in Montecito, California. They were associated with Nardcore, which was a part of the hardcore scene from Oxnard, which was nearby. RKL are a fucking... a Netflix series by themselves. The sort of story of them all is massive and long. And have a look at all of that on Wikipedia. I'm sure there's more stories out there. But yeah, it's a lot. Suffice to say, Chris Rest is the only consistent member. Other people have died or left. It's one of those kind of a band. So, but the RKL we're dealing with is Jason Sears on vocals, harmonica, and spoons. Chris Rest on guitar. Barry Delive Ward, guitars and vocals. And Bomber Manzullo playing drums and bass on this album, as well as the washboard and the Jaws harp. Additional musicians, Jim Schaffer playing banjo, Dan Seitz playing the refrigerator grill, which I, instead of the washboard for the little bluegrassy thing, and someone called Espo on vocals. Now, this was produced by Mark Deuterum, and he's been the guitarist in Clown Alley. I don't know them. And was also a bassist for 5 years in the Melvins.
Oh, cool.
Has also played with Sun O, ... that drone metal thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he's been doing all sorts of stuff here. He's done a bit of producing and stuff, but yeah, so he's done all sorts of things like that. And also the executive producer is a guy called Victor Hayden, who is better known as the Mascara Snake, who was a cousin of Captain Beefheart.
It's so interesting that you've just... I was just like, one of my first notes is like, so it's kind of like if Captain Beefheart did a punk album.
Not far off, really, yeah. So because the executive producer played bass clarinet on Trout Mask Replica.
No way.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's the biggie, isn't it? He co-founded Alchemy Records the year before with Mark Deuterum. Poison Idea, Melvins, Potbelly, various bands. He has a song about him named Mascara from John Frusciante on one of his solo albums. I just started laughing, and it's not funny, but it kind of is the way they phrased it on Wikipedia. Under death, Hayden died on December the 7th, 2018, from complications after being struck by a van.
Wow.
I don't know what's complicated, but fine. So he was there in an executive role, so I don't know how hands-on he was, but Jim Schaefer, who played banjo, was also engineer. Dan Stiles did the artwork and layout, and Doug Pensinger, the photography. Album cover is the band sat around on some lawn chairs with some cartoon artwork around them, which is all fun. It's 47 minutes long, Red. It's 15 tracks.
Yeah, you know, some of these tracks are 5 minutes.
Some of them are, yes. And a few of them nearly earn it. Well, okay, let's just go for first impressions. Had you heard RKL before?
No, I don't think I'm not aware of having listened to RKL previously. I was excited to listen to it. I thought it'd be something that I would enjoy. It is something that I enjoy. You know, I hate to bang on about the length of it at the top, but like, I just think that if this album had like 4 or 5 less tracks, I think it would be better. I think that I would listen to all of it more intently. Yeah, but overall pretty good, but I don't know if it has to be this long.
I'm not finding any sources of disagreement with you thus far. Yeah, I think that the length, I mean, reflected in just looking at how many notes I've made for each song, the length does impact it. We start off with Scab on My Brain. Now, I know for a fact that there was an Instagram post by Smelly of NoFX who was asked for his top 10 or top 20 punk songs. And this was one of them.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
He also only gave 19 because fuck you, I think, was the reason. I like it. It's a really good opener. And I think NoFX have taken that idea of opening with a banger. Could be from this one because it is really, really good. Bits of it feel like Venom to me.
That's interesting.
You know, this feels like a very crossover album. There are bits of it that are like metal, very metal in the influence, but without the guitar tones.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, particularly from the first track and then throughout, to be honest, I get a lot of Bad Brains vibes. And it comes from like what you're talking about in terms of like the guitars feeling a bit more metal on the metal side of punk, a bit more like from a thrash influence. Mm. And just generally like playing for speed, with like speed being one of the main things they're trying to achieve here. It reminds me of a lot of the Washington DC hardcore scene of the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there's an urgency, there's a directness. But with this, they also have tempo changes. They yes. also have sort of slow, that are breakdowns as such, because that means something else these days. I mean, I think at the moment, Lagwagon have 3 former members of RKL among their number.
Sure.
And have done for a long time. I think it was just after this album that Little Joe joined RKL as their bass player.
Yeah,
because obviously Bomber, who was like a founder member, played drums and bass, and I believe he also, I think he played bass live with for a while. They had a different drummer, and then I think he was the singer for a while. It's all
wow.
It's very much his sort of baby, along with, but he did leave and came back. But this has got 2 people. I should point out RKL have got 2 people from Doornails by NoFX.
Okay.
The singer, you know, this Patrones for Jason, that is the singer that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And these doses are for Bomber, again.
Of course.
And Derek Plaude, who was in Lagwagon as well, he played drums in them as well. So these 2 shots are for Derek. I think that's the same one. So there's 3 members of them in Doornails and 3 members of them in Lagwagon. Chris Rest was also in No Use for a Name for a time as well. Like this is a band sure. that has sort of permeated throughout. So it's very, very interesting. But I like Scab on My Brain. It's got a wah-wah solo and everything. It's like
yeah.
it's like super muso-y. It's really muso-y indeed. I can see where NoFX took a lot from this, but I think they always put the Bad Religion melody emphasis over the vocal approach of, because there are hooks in this, but they're shouted hooks. Yeah. This isn't a melodious album. It's a really fun album. Like, musically, it's really good, but I think the reason it fails to grab me as much is because it doesn't have the melody that I sort of need.
Absolutely. And I think that there's... I think if I have like a hot take about RKL, it's that I think that NOFX would sound exactly like this if they were better musicians. And I think that at the time, their skills, I think, you know, they've always played to their strengths, NOFX, and they've lent more into melody and songwriting, when I think this is what Mike and Smelly at least want to play all the time.
I know that Smelly sort of likes riffs. He's like a riff guy.
Yeah.
That's what he's always sort of drawn to. And, you know, that's... And you can see if you're going to be into RKL and stuff like that, then riffs are definitely the thing here. I'm going to say a thing which I had noted from the first time. The NOFX song that keeps coming back to me over and over again when listening to this. You have a guess what it is?
Is it Days to Days?
No, oddly enough, even though that would be a more direct sort of one-to-one, it's Sold Out.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I get those two mixed up in my head quite a lot, so yeah.
But Sold Out from White Trash, I think...
It is that. No, you're right, it is that. Yeah.
It's super RKL.
Yeah, no, it's... Yeah,
and
yeah.
It only occurred to me when listening through, specifically for this recording, where I was like, wait a minute.
And there's like three different songs that remind me of it as well.
The whole vibe, the whole approach...
Yeah.
All that, like, sort of keeping it kind of straightforward and simple on one chord while the singing, and then when the singing stops, play something riffy, and then go back to plain and simple for the vocals to sit on, then back again. God, that's a really, really arduous way of describing it. I'm sure there's a way. And also the bit at the end of Sticking in My Eye, all that stuff is... So yeah, I think it might be White Trash has got the most... Or maybe it's got the most effective, because they've got Hefe, who can actually play those riffs, play metal. They can lean a little more. And Melvin's got better than when they started out, so yeah.
Yeah, I think they get to a point where they are capable of playing a bit more like this.
And it's very interesting, because that came out, and then around the same time that first Propaganda album came out.
Yes.
And that's what massively influenced
Punk and Drublic.
Thank you. And so you wonder, if Propaganda hadn't been knocking around, what would their next album have sounded like? Because if they were like just going in this direction,
yeah,
and then all of a sudden they sort of change gear into what we now know as that skate punk sound. You know,
because if there's one genre that's heavily that I really hear here, which I don't hear at all in like any of NOFX's music, it's the prog influence. Like, this has got prog influence. This has got like, I mean, this feels like Caius. Some of this, and like, you like this like the stoner like desert rock.
Yeah, there's some in that halftime sort of...
I mean, it's much faster, but, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, even some of the halftime breakdowns you get all sorts of stuff. Anyway, yeah, so Hungover, which is... Hungover's got like a groove to it. Like, yeah, the actual guitar thing, it's like there's a sort of a sludgy, swampy groove to the drums are played kind of straight, but the actual guitars could be played with a slightly more sort of... I don't know if the word's syncopated or what, but some sort of slightly more groovy drum beat rather than the sort of straight ahead approach. But yeah, it's sort of the groove based riff that sort of matches the vocals, but there's so much sort of just random soloing and stuff in this album. There's a lot of it. It's like, it's a really good background album.
Yes.
Because it's kind of all got the same vibe. There are little bits of ups and downs here and there to change it. I don't want to sound like I'm dismissing it, because I'm really not. It's just not my vibe. But it's really good.
It's not been... It's great and we like it. It's not been refined to a level that we have grown accustomed to. I mean, like, this came out in 87, so like, fair play to it.
Absolutely,
It's almost like it's too much. Like, it's too great a volume of music and songs. And I get why it's been released like this in 87, because back then you didn't have the internet and you didn't have Spotify and you didn't have music at your fingertips. You had to go out and buy an album, and then that album would last you a couple years till you could get your hands on the next release. In that regard, back in 87, I bet this would have fucking ruled.
I would have loved this
because it doesn't end, but these days
I remember I remember when we used to go and buy CDs in Leeds, and we'd be on the bus back, been the Con Exchange and that, and someone would be looking at the back of their album and they'd be going, oh mate, 17 songs.
Yeah.
17. Like, super excited. What do you got? I got 12. 12? come to me next time. I know how to spend my money, thanks. You know, it's like, well, are they better songs? Doesn't matter. There's 17 of them. I'll get used to them eventually, you know. To be honest, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do a track-by-track breakdown of this, because they do kind of feel really similar.
I agree. I was just about to say.
It feels... This is like a vibe album rather than a specific song album.
Yeah.
And it's really good. I don't want people to come away thinking that I don't like this, because I do.
No, yeah, I'm right there with you. Like... It's great, but we have some concerns.
There's one thing I will point out is on Meltdown, the third song, it's sort of classic rock sort of riffs with like the punk speed and drumming, but there's a bit that sounds like that riff in Back to the Motor League by Propaganda.
Sure.
That little Motorhead kind of I'll face it, that in there. Catch Your Breath, I've written literally nothing, so we'll just skip that one. There's on Seeing You, there's like a Status Quo style riff, like na 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 na. It's just all in there, and I quite
it's all in there.
I quite like how all in there it is, and you can see that the executive producer was in the magic band. When you just go, oh, we're just going to do this now. Fucking have it, lads. Yeah, do it. Do you want a bass clarinet on it? No, we don't. Oh,
it was. It was actually around this point, listening to it, where one of the closest artists that this album reminds me of, and it's really funny because they're like a modern prog band, but this reminds me of, have you listened to any of King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard?
I have heard some of them, yes.
It reminds me of that, to be honest. It's sort of like really crunchy, sludgy, but proggy. Rock music, not necessarily a punk music or a hardcore music. It's a bit broader than that.
It's got all sorts on it. Oh yeah, something else I wanted to point out. It took me until this morning to work out who the vocalist reminded me of.
Sure, I think there's a few options.
There is, but the one that really stuck out to me, and I went, "Oh shit, it is." Staring me in the face, Niall from Midlife Punk Podcast.
Yeah, all right, yeah. So I was going to say like Stuzza Sturgeon or like, again, Bad Brains. I think it's quite similar vocals to Bad Brains, but
yeah, no, it was Niall. Nihilism. Really jumped out at me. And that's what I didn't put it in our group chat because I didn't want to spoil the reaction. Of the revelation on the podcast, but yeah, I because we'll mention it again, because we're doing this tribute to Punk and Droblik, we joined together with Midlife Punk Podcast. We've recorded a couple of songs under two different band names, but just because we had two names that were fun, and Niall sings our version of The Bruise,
yeah,
and And we were like, oh, wow, this sounds great. We didn't know that he sounded like that when he sang. He sounds a bit like this guy. So,
yeah.
Sounds a bit like Derek. I tell you what, though, a little standout one for me is Lay Your Weapons Down.
Yes, absolutely agree.
I thought that one was really, really good. That was like a highlight for me. Sort of an anti-violence song. It was sort of like that punk crossover thing, but again, without the production being super heavy. Like, the guitars are not heavy on this. They're like, yeah. Not even for the time. They're quite clean, quite low gain. And then it sort of goes into like Coming Home, which has got that hillbilly banjo and refrigerator thing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I know, like, it's, you know, it's not the best bit of the album, but at least there's something different here, like something to differentiate it. I know we've mentioned, I mean, this is the first album review we've done where we haven't broke down individual songs because there's so many like repeated themes and styles that it doesn't feel very helpful. But at least here they're breaking that tradition a little bit and chucking in something of note.
A sonic cleanser, basically. Yeah. It just sort of, I mean, you do go back pretty quick, although this is sort of like more mid-tempo.
Yes,
it's sort of more like a rock song than it is a punk song.
And with like more, the lyrics are a bit more what you'd expect of like a classic rock song, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going home, I've been on the road.
Yeah, yeah. It could be a Dropkick Murphys song.
Yes.
Put some bagpipes on it or something, you know, the old road dog. Oh, don't even remember what my own bed looks like.
Yeah.
But yeah, which is cool. Sargasm. I mean, I've written first sort of repetitive vibe for me. And I think I was being generous because I was like, this one just passed me by completely.
Oh, okay.
It's not bad, but it's the first one where, you know, where you become, you know, your own house doesn't smell because you live in it. And then people sure. come round and they go, oh, it smells like your house. You go, what do you mean? My house is totally neutral. There's no aroma whatsoever. You're like, no, it doesn't smell bad. It just smells like your house because of the combination of stuff in it.
Yeah.
And this is when I've become nose blind with my ears. Deaf, that's the word.
I think this song is one of the ones that I really hear the influence on NoFX.
Yes. Because yeah, that's true, actually.
If Mike came up with the innuendo sargasm, you goddamn bet your life it would be a song title on his next album. Like, yeah. I bet he loved that shit growing up. Because this is 87, so he must have been, like, you know, young at the time listening to this.
Yeah.
I bet this blew his mind wide open. He was like, wait, sarcasm, orgasm, holy fucking shit.
And I like both of those things. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I that could be, you think that's where his...
It's where Haruana came from.
Yeah, his love of the portmanteau comes from, or his malapropisms and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, maybe. Break the Camel's Back, which I like. The gang vocals on that sound really, really good.
Yeah, it might be one of my favorite tracks, actually, Break the Camel's Back. I think it's got all of the best bits of the album.
Yeah, I think actually, yeah, if you were going to pick it out, or I'd pick out maybe the next song, Blocked Out, which I like as well. The big intro, the massive, massive build. It's 5 minutes long, and I think the first minute is just the big intro.
Yeah.
There is, in fact, a live version that Fat Mike has recommended before from around this time. It's got Lil Joe playing the bass, and the intro is even bigger. It starts off with like Joe doing a lot of like up the top of the neck bass wankery.
Yeah.
And it's in that, you know, in the decline when you get
yes.
That style of sort of hammer on up the top of the neck kind of thing. I think Mike has taken a lot from this.
Yeah, definitely.
Lil Joe plays one of those Steinberger headless basses.
Oh, okay.
Those little ones that look like a little cricket bat. Mm-hmm. And Mike played one of those for a long time, specifically because of Lil Joe. He broke it in the Sticking in My Eye video. Tribute to the Jester. This is the first song where I sort of think you could have defo left this one out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the others, I think none of them... All the previous ones, none of them stick out as being like, oh, you could just get rid of that one, apart from maybe Catch Your Breath. But this one, I'm like, come on, lads, we could have saved 4 minutes on this.
Well, there's a few longer tracks here. And yeah. Between Break the Camel's Back, Blocked Out, Tribute to the Jester, Rock and Roll Nightmare, I feel like you probably only need two of those. I don't know. It's a lot of long songs to put near each other.
They're all in a row as well. These are 4 or 5 minute songs. There's like a 20 minute sequence in this that's just four songs.
Yeah.
That's a lot of that. And I don't know that it works.
Well, here's the thing. When you judge it by punk standards or hardcore standards, this is strange. But I actually think that what they're going for is much more of like a stoner rock, you know, like prog metal thing, at which point this isn't unusual at all, and if anything it's quite short.
Well, yeah, and I suppose if you're looking at the Metallica albums that were out at the same time,
yeah,
you've got like Ride the Lightning and Kill 'Em All. When was Master of Puppets? Was that 88, something like that? But you've got and some of those songs, some of the, you know, and those are like 10 songs long, and they've got like,
yeah,
they're like 50 minutes or something daft, you know, they've got like 8 minute got 8 minute instrumentals on those albums, you know, so they'd be thinking, no, this is positively pop music by comparison. So, you know, that's fine. It's I think it's because it feels so influenced by like 70s rock.
Yes.
It feels very, it feels a bit
like
throwback-y.
Grateful Dead almost.
Yeah, to a degree, it feels a bit throwbacky. Yeah, Rock and Roll Nightmare. I was like, yeah, it's quite good, but fine. And then the funniest thing is that the song after that, Alone Inside, that's what, like 2 and a bit minutes?
Yeah, well, then the final three tracks are all under 3 minutes.
Yeah. And Alone Inside does merge into One Light, One Mind. So yes, you could count those as one song. That's, again, another 4 minute, 5 minute song, really. But it's sort of... It's the slowest one, or Alone Inside, and it's got sort of the most ballady kind of... I'm using ballad incorrectly, but you know what I mean. That's
so the shortest and slowest song.
Yeah, but it's kind of just an intro to One Light, One Mind, which is good, but it's still sort of more of the same. Find a Way, I've written, kind of want this to be over. Because my patience starts to wear thin. But it's got a really weird Walk This Way vibe to it, in the way that the vocals are done, like in a Run DMC sort of style.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Which does actually make it stand out and be slightly different and slightly more memorable. So clearly I wrote those in order, because I wouldn't mind this song at all if a couple of the others had been chopped out.
I think this is a selection of songs that have been chucked together in an album, and I don't think there's been a great deal of time and attention spent on sequencing or you know, the song selection in general. It just doesn't feel very curated or refined, but for all those faults, it's really good. They're a great band. They know how to play their instruments.
I'm thinking what we're getting here is a substandard representation of what would be an excellent live band.
Yeah.
I think that this is one of those albums where you're like, oh, this is pretty good. You go, no, mate, but if you see them live, fuck.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I think it is.
Getting like Butthole Surfers vibes from this, who are, again, like a band famous for putting on a great live show, but not necessarily being the best on a record.
And it's hard to do, and especially when they've got limited resources to put themselves on a record.
Yeah.
They don't have major label backing and stuff like that. People were like, oh, come on. I mean, you listen to Appetite for Destruction and it sounds immense. And they were an amazing live band at that time. You go, yeah, but they had a major label putting the money up to record them in a way that represented that. These guys, less so.
It's almost
these
as
guys
if, like,
had Captain Beefheart's cousin.
It's almost like this is like the raw material which we eventually harvest Dookie from. You know, like in, you know, obviously I'm using that as a benchmark because that's an album that we've recently reviewed on this show. But like, I feel like a lot of what we talk about on this show kind of starts around here. And obviously, you know, like there's influences past this point, you know, time is infinite. But I do think that whilst we have criticism of this, you know, it feels unrefined to us. Mm. We're looking at it from a 2024 lens. Think that over time these themes and ideas got refined and sanded down and made a little bit more efficient, and then you end up with 90s albums like Punkin' Drublic, like Dookie, that were directly influenced by things like this. But you know, you don't get 90s punk rock without late 80s hardcore.
No, certainly not. And I don't want anyone to come away thinking that this is a negative thing. No. There's always going to be personal taste involved in this. And, you know, I didn't listen to RKL until I was in my 30s. It was just one of the many bands that I just didn't happen upon. And it was mainly because Mike talked about it so much in various interviews and stuff that I went and listened to it. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, it's good. But it never inspired me to sort of dig any deeper. But it was, they were one of those bands that I thought was just a piece of the puzzle. I'm like, oh, yeah. I see where the bridge is from that to that. And I like hearing those albums. And I like I remember talking to someone about Operation Ivy. And he was saying that he wasn't that bothered about them because he said, oh, when I was, it was actually Daniel Powell from Across This Universe podcast. He said that he went on like a lookout bender, like every band that had ever been on lookout. He was like, I need to find out all about this because Green Day put out their early, you know, their early stuff on lookout and all this kind of stuff. And he's like, yeah, I got the Operation Ivy album and I thought it was okay. But I didn't really get what the big whoop was about. But, you know, I listened to Operation Ivy when I was about 14. And I was just astounded that you could sound like that. And bands like Crimp Shrine and that sort of Gilman core, or if you want to, no one's ever called it that. But, you know, that kind of thing, you sort of, sometimes you hear one of the pieces of the puzzle and you go, I prefer that piece in this puzzle, not the original puzzle.
Yeah.
And... you know, it's like some people don't like, you know, I know a friend of mine doesn't really like cinnamon, but their mum told them to put it in their shepherd's pie sauce because you don't notice it, but you do notice it when it's not there. And it's that kind of thing. It's like, yeah, this is one of the ingredients. This is one of the bricks used to build the house that we want to live in. It's that kind of a thing. But it's actually more than that, because it isn't just something that I respect. It is something that I do like. And if one of these songs came up on shuffle, any of them, on their own, I'd be like perfectly happy. It would not be a skipper. In that respect, there's not a single skipper on this album.
Yes, completely.
But equally, as an album, it doesn't work the way I like albums to work.
I think
a symphony kind of thing.
I think one of the biggest tragedies of like punk rock and a lot of music that we listen to is because it doesn't have that corporate backing, it's actually quite difficult to find and get hold of. So for instance, I didn't start listening to NoFX until I was in my 20s because like growing up, if it wasn't on Kerrang or if it wasn't on MTV2 or they weren't really in the NME, then I wasn't really like aware of them as a band. And then it took my 20s, you know, with the internet and Bandcamp and so many things that made finding music way easier, that I was able to find bands like NoFX. And, you know, I didn't listen to NoFX until I was in my 20s. And I unfortunately didn't get to listen to RKL until I was in my 30s. Because, I mean, you know, if you can't uncover no effects in, you know, 2006, then, you know, you're not going to find RKL, are you?
No, it's
and that's unfortunate,
unlikely.
Because I think if I would listen to this music when I was a teenager, I do think my taste would be, you know, more refined. I think I would have a lot of the punk music that I listen to now is music that I wish I would have listened to as a teenager. It was the kind of music that I was looking for as a teenager and couldn't find.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. It's, I might have mentioned this before, but, Josie Long, the comedian, when she was young, she would listen to bands like Hole.
Yeah.
Because you could get their, were they even on Top of the Pops with Celebrity Skin and stuff like that?
I don't think so. But
they were on chart, you know, they charted with it. It was a single that you could buy in the UK. And she's like, I listened to that because I didn't know about Bikini Kill.
Yes, fair.
So you get the thing that scratches the itch until you find the thing that is actually what you want. You go, oh right, because, you know, Hole was Bikini Kill, and at that period filtered through Billy Corgan's more poppy sensibilities, you know, and it was like the most cleanly produced of it all, but, you know, he still had Courtney's voice over it, which sounded really, really good. And you're like, oh right, so she's wearing like a pretty dress, but it is ragged and her eyeliner is all fucked up. What, you know, and that's if that's the first person you see looking like that, your mind is blown.
Absolutely,
like, whoa! And then you find out the sort of lineage of all of that, you know, it's that's the sort of exciting thing, you know. And so God bless RKL for making this into a thing and you know, they essentially live on. I mean, I think they do still technically live on. I think they do, or they have done gigs sort of fairly recently with
who, RKL. You know,
yeah, various members of them.
Well, I think they've released Live in a Dive in 2022.
They did. Was that 20?
Release. On Spotify, it says Live in a Dive with RKL was released in 2022, but I don't know if that's like a re-release.
Yeah, it was, yep. Yes, it was. I mean, they sort of released... the last studio album they released was 1994.
Right.
And then a lot of people died. But then they sort of split up in what looks like about 97, started again in 2002, which is... and then looks like they've just started up again this year.
That's cool.
Yeah, with... Tony Foresta on vocals, who sang in Municipal Waste, Iron Reagan, and Heaven's Gate. Chris Rest, of course, of Lagwagon. Joe Raposo, who's Lil Joe. Dave Rawn on drums and Barry Ward on guitar. So, yep, they're doing stuff now. Interesting sort of thing. So they're a really weird band in the history sense of it, and just sort of what they were and what they are. But I think this album in particular helps contextualize a lot of the things that we talk about on this podcast with regards to NOFX and the surrounding 90s skate punk bands. That's my theory anyway. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah.
Great. I don't know about you. You got any closing thoughts on this one?
I think I you know, I've really enjoyed it. I've had, you know, I feel like I'm on, you know, like the last round of like a TV quiz show, like Bullseye. Right. Like, oh, I've had a lovely time, Jim.
Yeah. You know what? Whatever happens now, yeah, I've had a lovely, yeah. Like, well, I'm so sorry you didn't make it through to the final. I've had a brilliant day. I've had a brilliant day.
You know, I've really enjoyed this. It's been such a great experience. No, I'm really glad that I've actually spent some time like listening to RKL. I'm going to listen to more of them. I'm quite intrigued by their little mascots that appear on their album covers.
Yeah.
The little Dennis the Menace. Presumably these are the rich kids on LSD.
I can tell you this from Wikipedia. The group's name came about as a mere fluke from some light-hearted criticism, according to vocalist Jason Sears in 2002 with Thrasher magazine. It happened that some guy said, "Ha, those kids will never be anything. They're just a bunch of rich kids on LSD, man." The first party we played didn't have a name for the band, so we put that on the flyer and it just stuck. The Beanie Boy logo was born one night when Bomber and Jason were being tattooed. Bomber was attempting to draw a dragon pattern. On seeing the drawing, Jason commented, "Yeah, it's Cecil. Where's Beanie?" So so Beanie and Cecil is apparently a cartoon on American television. Dan Seitz was sitting alongside drawing a flyer for a show supporting suicidal tendencies in Oxnard, drew a Beanie guy jumping from a building, and Beanie Boy was born. That little Dennis the Menace-y looking character is called Beanie Boy.
That's interesting.
I think there's another album cover where he's like tied to some railway tracks, like in a silent film and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's cool. Like he gets up to all sorts. He's being turned into a robot in 1993's Reactivate.
Oh yeah. No, it's kind of cool when it's like a little Eddie from Iron Maiden or Vic Rattlehead from Megadeth, the Eddie no one asked for that was done, but the guy who did S&M Airlines cover designed
that's
that, I believe. Yeah. Oh, it's all sticking in there, all the trivia. If you want to have a very loyal following, irrespective of what you do, get yourself a little mascot.
Maybe we need a punk rock elite mascot.
We've got Eyeball, but I don't know if Eyeball is enough.
Have got the Eyeball, you know.
That's
maybe.
True. We actually do have another one. We've got a logo that we didn't use from Chris, Things on Fire. We got one that's a fun dinosaur.
Yeah, fun dinosaur.
I mean, the problem is it's sort of like a very dark pink dinosaur, and I don't know if we'd get in legal trouble for using what amounts to a purple dinosaur.
There's a Barney movie is in development currently.
Oh.
Daniel Kaluuya's Barney.
Really?
That's a real thing. I'm not making it up.
Is that you, Tea Leaf?
I think that it will be very subversive and probably on A24. And, you know, it won't be the Barney that we all know and love.
I see. Barney was a little after my time, you see. I was, and not that it ever got massive in the UK anyway. Is he in public domain now, or are they just fucking around with it? Or...
Oh, that's a good point. I actually don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
Presumably not.
Is Jordan Peele producing it?
I think so. Or actually, I should check.
I mean, I know that they're work together buddies, but we could probably talk about this at another time.
Daniel Kaluuya's Barney the Dinosaur film is going to be adult and lean into millennial angst. That is on The Guardian. Meanwhile, it's inspired by Charlie Kaufman, who did Adaptation and Synodoc New York.
Is it going to be basically some millennials and then every so often Barney appears like a spectre in the corner? It's going to be like Harvey.
I bet it's straight to streaming and a bit shit. Greta Gerwig is also planning two Narnia movies.
I love Narnia. Anyway.
So do I. I feel like if you're going to make a Narnia movie, you're probably going to need a British director. And maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just back on my bullshit. But like, it feels very innately British. It'd be like, you know, if you let, I don't know, Christopher Nolan direct Oklahoma. I just don't think it'd have... Yeah,
Christopher Nolan's Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah.
Like, right, first of all, Cillian Murphy is playing Joe. Like, oh, right, no, we don't need that. That is... Can we not? Anyway, so Rock and Roll Nightmare by RKL, Rich Kids on LSD. If you've not listened to it, listen to it. It will, things will start to make sense.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing. You may find your new favorite record. You really might, because it seems that the people who go for this properly go for it. Like, and I can see why they would. And I can also see why you might listen to it and go, okay, and afterwards. But it's contextualizing for me. So yeah, I did enjoy listening to it again, and I'm glad I gave it the time that I did.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, let's jump on over to the outro. And we're here at the outro. Welly, 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 well. Was something, wasn't it?
Welly, well, indeed. Yes. Yeah, really glad that we've covered this as well, like, because it's a little bit outside of both of our comfort zones, really, which is what these Under the Influence episodes are all about, learning about where NoFX came from and how the sound came to be.
Yes, there's one more Under the Influence album that I think we're going to do fairly soon. We'll do some more later on in the year.
And if anybody has any suggestions as well for things that they know heavily influence Mike, particularly if there's a specific album, we'd love to hear.
Yes, there is one, and I think it's going to be the one that is least like NoFX.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yes, it's interesting. So there's that. We're still going to be doing the peer pressures. Got more Backstage Passport coming up. We've still got probably two more episodes of that for the first series.
We've got to get some interviews booked in as well. You know, to maybe the organisers of Manchester Punk Festival or...
Yep, and we've got some more NoFX, more closely NoFX related discussions in the pipeline. And a lot of our time is being taken up thinking about the Punk in Drublic tribute album. We are in the process of approaching record labels. Do you own a record label?
No.
I was talking to the listener.
Sure. Yeah. Right. No, sorry about that.
Do you own a record label?
No, I don't. No.
No, Red. I was doing it again.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Just right. I'll do a question. Right. I'll do a pause, and then I'll act as if someone at home has said yes.
Sure.
All right. Do you own a record label? Because we need one, and we would like to, if you would like some, we've listened to most of the tracks have come in, and they are sounding excellent. We will, once we know what's going on, we will start to tease you with snippets. We will let you hear some little bits of it here and there. Between us and Midlife Punk Podcast, we'll get some, they'll get others. And we'll drip out little clips of them, and because it's going to be great, it will be for a charity. We're still working out which charity that is. It will be hopefully coming out on physical media again. We need to work out what that is, because we're talking to people. If we can't find a record label, we're talking about crowdfunding it. Is that a sort of thing that you would potentially, and I'm talking to the listener again, Red, is that the sort of thing that you would countenance? Would you consider that as a thing? Would you consider that a good idea? We're all very open to suggestions at the moment, so if you do have any for putting out a compilation tribute for charity, if you have that specific experience, let us know. We'd love to hear. punkrockelitepodcast@gmail.com. Or you can always find us on Instagram at Punk Rock Elite Podcast. I'm not sure. You get Punk Rock Elite Podcast into Insta, type it in, we'll come up with Eyeball, our mascot. I'm trying to make it a thing now. So yeah, do that, and hopefully we'll be back. I'm looking at the time. I feel like we may have possibly shortchanged you on this, but because this isn't as long as we normally do the episodes. But I think that Rock and Roll Nightmare is a very specific sort of album. That
yeah, I think what we didn't want to just keep repeating ourselves.
Yes, of course. Yes, we could have made this the longest episode we've ever done.
We could have. We really could.
But I don't really think anyone would have dug that, so we'll do it this way. But, you know, that's how it goes sometimes. There's more to say about some stuff than others.
And let us know as well, like, what you guys think of RKL's Rock and Roll Nightmare.
Yep, or RKL in general. Please let us know. Same rules apply. It's like we said in the intro, we're not rushing to talk about Ramones or the Sex Pistols or what have you, because what are we adding to the conversation?
Yeah.
It's been had, it's been done. All of the opinions and potential takes, hot, tepid or otherwise, are out there.
Well, here's the thing. This week I saw the band The Hives. I mentioned this to you. Basically, the band The Hives, they were due to play in Ireland, but due to the storm, they couldn't get over there. So instead, they've rescheduled that date, and instead, they just came to Sheffield, and they performed a show at the Leadmill, which is the venue that I work at. It was booked over a weekend, tickets sold out in 15 minutes. It was, you know, it's quite a big show for us. But their opening act was a band called Bad Nerves, perfectly decent. I'm not knocking them. If you're a fan of them, fair play. But what I do think is quite interesting is, like, their bassist is on stage, full on, just in my mind, and maybe this is, but it looked like Sid Vicious cosplay. Like, he's got the spiky hair. He's got a necklace, which is also a padlock. He's got a red tank top with, like, the sleeves cut off. And, you know, and he's playing a P bass and he's doing the stance. And I'm just a bit like, but do we need that in, like, 2024? Like, we all love Sid. Like, oh, God bless him. What a man. Even if, you know, his views were questionable. And he did wear a few too many swastikas. But, like,
what's the problem with you wokes? What's wrong with that?
It felt a bit like, I'm like, sure, but I feel like that look's been emulated for, like, since the 70s. And I'm just not sure what value it's doing in being put on stage now in 2024. And I don't know, maybe that's, you know, maybe I'm going a bit too hard on Bad Nerves. They sounded absolutely fine. They were good.
Sure. I just had a quick look, and when you type Bad Nerves into Google, it comes up with badnerves.com or whatever their webpage is. Yes. Just currently the best band on the planet. I'm like, oh.
I mean, you're supporting The Hives, so I'd fucking wind your neck in. Like,
yeah.
You're supporting the band that does claim that, but, you know,
your new favorite band. There's nothing you can do about it.
Like, The Hives recently tweeted in the last week, We are the greatest band on the planet, the Earth, and the Milky Way. I mean, two of those things are the same thing, and the Milky Way isn't a place. But I don't think that is an incorrect statement. I think the Hives are right.
Well, actually, Red, planets are round and the Earth isn't, so I think you want to wind your neck in.
Well, there you go.
It's in a book, Red. Best band under the firmament is what I think they meant. The thing is that there's sort of a lot of talk about how this sort of posturing and stuff is like, oh yeah, we're rock and roll and you suck, you scum. And people do that in a sort of arch, eyebrow raised, ironic way where people go, oh, that is good. Because people like arrogant rock stars. You know, that people have been attracted to that kind of thing, you know, certainly since the 80s, the hair metal-y thing, you know, people like rock stars to sort of stand there and not be shy, and they like to sort of be bombastic, you know, they've not got their shirt on and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine, but if you're doing it in exactly the same way that someone else did it, that's...
Yeah.
Because, like, when The Hives did it, like, I saw The Hives in 1999.
Wow.
In the cockpit in Leeds. Not even the main room, the side room.
Fucking hell.
And they were supporting the Yo-Yos, which is Danny from the Wild Hearts' side project. and group dog drill or dog toffee, one of the two. And the hives, and they were just sort of wearing like, they weren't in suits and stuff. They were just sort of, they were just sort of similar, but not the same. And they were fine. They were all right. When they decided they were going to be matching suit wearing, coiffured, like their sort of arrogance actually came from a sort of a primped preening, we've all done our hair nice and we are wearing like fully tailored matching suits.
Yeah.
And all the rest of it is, that's when that swagger became a thing. And it's like, that's not the same as, oh, I'm wearing ripped jeans. It's like, no, if these trousers are ripped, we throw them away. We don't wear repaired trousers. We're the Hives. You know, it was sort of that kind of angle they were coming from. And it's like, okay, yeah, that's a new, or it felt new. It was like all the sort of pomp and the sort of the mod obsession with clothes that Indy was doing.
Yeah.
With the sort of energy, you know, they're a garage punk, I suppose, is the sort of their genre. And it's not one of my favorites, but live they are brilliant. There's no two ways about it. They're just properly good. But on record, they're fine for me. It's just how it is for me. But that's how it goes. Because I then saw them on their tour after they'd done Hate to Say I Told You So, with Sahara Hot Nights and Randy, and that was when I first saw Randy the band, and then I was like, oh hello, this is what I want.
Fair.
Oh, yeah, love Randy. Yeah, cool. Well, if you have any feelings on any of that thing, what is it to be a rock star these days? Can you be one? Or have all of the options been taken up and we're just having to recycle them?
Am I being really unfair? Like, am I being annoyed at punks for dressing like punks? I don't know. Just feels a bit derivative to me.
I suppose you're always wondering if they have the chops to back it up. Because anyone, and also there's that thing of dressing like a punk became a joke in the UK in about 1978.
Yeah.
Like the two Ronnies and stuff would have like sketches where they had like mohawk wigs and you know, it became a very sort of, it became sort of like you could buy Mohican wigs in joke shops and stuff like that. And it became kind of predictable by itself. Not that I hate seeing a mohawk. I still think it's cool, but I don't know if that's, I don't know. We'll see anyway. Thank you so much for listening, everybody.
Thank you.
And thank you, Red.
Thank you, Eddie.
You're welcome. We will see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Punk Rock Elite. It was a Pick Scraped and Fruitcake co-production by Eddie French and Red Redmond. If you're not following us on Instagram or subscribe to the podcast, please do. The main theme and production was done by Eddie French. Please contact us at punkrockelitepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you.